Welcome to the Daily Ben Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Ms. Sarah Gon. Sarah, how are you?
Good, thanks. You, Nick?
I'm very well, thank you. And Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you?
Oh, man, I'm enjoying the fact that it's getting warmer.
Yes, no, it's very lovely, actually. Yes, we seem, hopefully, to be coming out of winter. We missed you all yesterday, of course, because it was the long weekend, and we hope that those of you who had a chance to enjoy the long weekend enjoyed the long weekend. Let's get right on it with a very quick update from Gabriel on COVID numbers. Now, we talked a little bit about this last week and about why South Africa's COVID numbers are perhaps not that reliable. Gabriel, why don't you explain what's going on?
Yeah, so all over the news, all over the radio, the TV, the newspapers, you're hearing stenographers of the state repeat Dr. William Keyes's line that there's an observed plateau or even a reduction in several provinces of COVID cases. And so it looks like large parts of the country have passed the peak. That is true in the Western Cape, and it's been true for a long time. It's not at all clear that it's true anywhere else. The factors that have been overlooked are the positivity rate, or the positive rate, the proportion of tests that come out positive, which remain nationally at around 25%. That means we do four tests for every positive case that we find. The World Health Organization recommends that you're not really finding the true rate of spread if your positivity rate is above 12%. So we're double that. So that's one reason that we already covered. Another reason is that the testing numbers have gone down. I've just generated a graph that shows South Africa's new cases and South Africa's new tests. And from about the 20th of July, there's a perfect fit. As the tests go down, the cases go down. In fact, the only time that the fit is not perfect is right in the last couple of days, where the tests keep going down, but the cases go up. Again, that's because the positivity rate is climbing. The third factor, which is just a brief update, is that I was trying to figure out where have the test reductions come from. And I looked up the NCID data and have just collated its data on tests that are done from community screening versus tests that are called passive, which is where people come to hospital to get tested. And it's the community in the community screening you see from the same peak period around the 20th of July. We've got a 7-day rolling average of almost 10,000 tests per day. And that's come down to about 7,000 in the last couple of in the last week. It's actually come down to 5,000. So we're doing much less screening tests. We're doing much less go out there and find cases tests. So it should be absolutely no surprise that as a result, we're finding less cases. But it's dangerous and delusional to think that that means the virus isn't continuing to spread exponentially. And the reason I think no one's covering this is because either, you know, people just naively believe the state, or even if they don't believe the fake numbers, or the numbers that aren't fake but that aren't acknowledging the reduction in testing, they want the lockdown to end. They want the cigarette ban to end. They want the alcohol ban to end. They want business as usual. And if the government needs an excuse of, well, look, we've beaten the virus to get there, then I think a lot of media houses are sort of willing to let that fly if they can tell the good news anyway. So I think we should end the lockdown, again, not because it's working, but precisely because it's not working. The virus looks very much like it's continuing to spread exponentially.
And this is definitely a story we will return to later in the week, as, of course, we get more data and as we follow it more closely. But that's food for thought. Right. Let's move on to our next topic, which is, of course, Women's Day, which was on Sunday. It was, of course, commemorating the 1956, I believe, Women's March Against the Pass Laws during apartheid. And it's a day that has a kind of familiar pantomime to it, which is that we always have a speech from the president. We usually talk about women who suffer from domestic violence. And so we always, I think there's a fair amount of cynicism that sets in about Women's Day, because it's not really clear whether the government is making progress on some of the things it claims to make progress on. And of course, there's a lot of crowing about stuff that probably isn't, shouldn't be top of our agenda. Sarah, what are your thoughts?
I dislike Women's Day. I dislike Women's Month. I think that when you sort of devote an institutional holiday to half of the population, just because they are half of the population, I just don't like it at all. I think it's very patronizing, as our colleague Ivor Fechter said in a column today. Yeah. Certainly women have certain disadvantages, but from a legal point of view, the law is equal. And it's a matter for women and women's organizations or men's organizations to fight for those rights through the law, and through social pressure and through other forms of pressure. But there's sort of, there's something about the president sitting there saying, yeah, you know, women and gender-based, as you said, gender-based violence, and we're going to reserve at least 40% of contracts to black women, et cetera, et cetera. It's patronizing, and B, we know it's not going to happen. Whatever most of what women need, actually men in this country need too. And if you concentrate on women as this sort of some, this large, vaguely helpless group, as opposed to improving the lot of lives of men and women, you're actually wasting your time. And the problem is the government is not. The criminal justice system is in very bad shape. The economy is in worse shape. And those things are needed to be improved, whatever your gender or sex or whatever it may be. Either way, it's not a woman-only, men-only thing. It's a people thing.
Gabriel, are you a fan of Women's Day?
I'm a big fan of Mother's Day. One reason I like Mother's Day is because it's not a government thing. Like, it's just a voluntary private thing. And I think that mothers are, like, if you're going to box people, categorize people, I think mothers probably contribute the most good to society of any particular category that you can figure out. Also, it's a nice excuse to go for a picnic. So, big fan of Mother's Day. Women's Day, by contrast, I share Sarah's hesitancy about getting enthusiastic about it. And I think Ivor Fechter drew attention to an interesting paradox, which is that there's a sort of matriarchal tendency to say we as men need to protect women, that it's a manly thing to do to protect women, rather than to think that it's sort of human thing to do to protect everyone, or a good citizen, the kind of thing a good citizen does. And what Fechter notices is that this used to be, he finds this to be a sort of central archetype in stereotypical Afrikaner culture in the 70s. And many people think of that culture as being very right wing. And today, those who push the Women's Day social identity agenda are typically very left wing. But I think that there's this commonality. Which is sort of trying to pick people out by categories, trying to reinforce it through government symbolism and government laws, preferential laws about gender and race and so on. And it's just really when the government gets involved that it raises my hackles. And I've been going over Anthea Jeffrey's book, BEE, Helping or Hurting. And it's, it was really shocking to go over one particular case where an Indian woman a few years ago was applying to be promoted in the police force. And the government literally said, for this position at this police station, we need 0.4 of a woman and 0.2 of an Indian. And so if you multiply it together, we need 0.1 of an Indian woman, and we round that down to zero. So we need zero Indian women in this position. And so we're not hiring her. Like, it doesn't matter how good she is, we're not hiring her. that's a terrible sort of it's a terribly telling story about what BEE does. And through Mark Oppenheimer, I followed cases both in the South African, in the Gauteng bar and in the Western Cape bar, where black women have explicitly been denied promotion by vote because the quotas said, you know, we need one black man, one black woman, two black men, two black women, one white man, one white woman. But then when you actually tally up the votes, there are a couple of black women that would have qualified for the leg up, but because the black woman quota of two had already been filled, were shanked. And I think, you know, Ramaphosa, if he spoke about that on Women's Day, maybe it'll all be worth it. You know, it's like, maybe we need to rethink our quota system because perversely, one of the things that it's holding back are hardworking, talented black and Indian women. I can't say that I do.
I don't see Ramaphosa doing that anytime soon. Final thoughts?
I think one of the things we've refused to acknowledge, and this is may sound very, very weird, but, you know, as long as women and men have equal access to education and get the education that they are capable of achieving, and going into the professions or the jobs that they want to go to, that's what matters. The fact that there may be a lot more women in a profession and a lot more men in another profession doesn't matter. No, to say in this day and age that women dominate in nursing because society has socialized them into that, I think it's absolute nonsense. I mean, maybe within your own family you'll get that sort of pressure depending on the ethos of the family, but as a societal ethos, it's nonsense. It doesn't exist anymore, and I think we have to, and it makes that the sort of 1% Indian woman thing, BEE, so categorization, even more obscene.
No, very well said. And if you'd like to read the Ibofecta piece that we have just been talking about, you can read it on the dailyfriend.co.za, and it's called Stop Patronizing Women. Right, let's move on to our next topic, which is that business organization Sakalika has surveyed 1,000 respondents on the issue of a tax revolt. Now, this is the thing that's been kicked around South Africa sort of mostly on Facebook groups for a long time. Helen Ziller is perhaps one of the most prominent people to suggest that it might be a feasible option for resisting government maladministration and corruption. Sakalika found from their survey that people were basically very unhappy with the way their tax money was being spent. 95% of those questions said they were now less willing to pay tax, given how government has handled the pandemic and subsequent lockdowns. And interestingly, less than 1 in 8 respondents categorically rejected the idea of a tax revolt, or whether it was illegal or otherwise. So this raises the question, is a tax revolt likely, and is it a good idea? Gabriel?
It's already happening. It's been happening. All of the taxes that might have gone to legitimate purveyors of cigarettes and other tobacco products and alcohol have been cut out. And so everyone like me, who's continued to buy cigarettes and booze, I've become a tax dodger. I never wanted to be a tax dodger, but I'm now a tax dodger because I'm not paying the sin tax and the VAT and whatever on the illegal smokes and booze. So I'm kind of bleak about that because I really do aspire to be a good citizen. I might be a lazy lot a lot of the time, but I have high aspirations. But the government put an addiction between me and reaching those, and the addiction won, unsurprisingly. So that's one sense in which it's been happening. Another sense in which it's been happening is the, you know, what's sometimes called the investment strike. Which I think is an absurd phrase, because a strike is something that takes coordination. You have to have a union meeting to agree that we're now all going to not go to work for a while so we can have collective bargaining power, collective being the operative term. When you have an investment strike, what you actually have is a lot of people saying, well, my money I could invest in South Africa and then have it be subject to expropriation without compensation, to threats on the South African Reserve Bank, to effectively being drained away by rotting SOE corpses that keep getting force-fed. Or I could invest it in a proper country where property rights are well defended, where enterprise is rewarded and not punished, and people make the choice to invest elsewhere. And if you're investing elsewhere and you're not bringing the dividends back home, and instead you're reinvesting them, then if it's not like you're dodging taxes, but you are avoiding taxes, and that has been happening at an extremely, it's a major force in our economy. So I just think that it's tax morality in South Africa was one of the highest in the world in the 2000s. Mm. At the same time that SARS was one of the most respected revenue collectors services in the world. And then Zuma got in. His buddy said that if you criticize SARS, then you must be plugging for white monopoly capital. If you criticize Zuma and his friends, you must be plugging for white monopoly capital. In fact, the only guys in SARS who were trying to do their job, not the only guys, but some of the best guys trying to do their job, they were accused of being a rogue unit in service of white monopoly capital or Mossad or the CIA or the dead apartheid state or whoever it was. There are various theories being thrown around, some of them taken very seriously by the Sunday Times. And tax morality has demonstrably fallen since then. And I think that, it's like as people – I'm just trying to say there's a normative side and there's a descriptive side. I think the descriptive side is people are already much less willing to pay their taxes. And this is exacerbated by the COVID, by the plague and the lockdown in particular. But on the other, in a way, the thing that goes with it is as people change their behavior, they look for reasons to justify it. And also the reasons they change their behavior is sometimes because they justify it in the first place, because the government has been looting the fiscus, the public purse. Daily Maverick calculated 1/3 of GDP was looted under Zuma. So, yeah, who wants to give money so that it can be robbed?
To pick up on Gabriel's theme, I think the taxes are being lost and have been lost for as long as employment has plummeted, unemployment has grown. Every person that loses a job is failing to, it will not be able to pay tax over to the fiscus, and of course aggravated by the by COVID-19 is the slow rate at which industries, sectors are going back to work. So it's taking them longer to get back to work. There's less industry and less business as a result by the time they do get back. Fewer people retain their employment. And so taxes are just disappearing they're just lessening. And they will do. It's not a deliberate action in that sense. And then there's also that attitude, and I know it from sort of closer to home, the kind of they have so abused our money in the worst senses of the world. I am going to work less and earn less to pay less. I'll find, I have other ways of keeping body and soul together. I think that part of the government's delusion is that it really just doesn't realize how angry people are.
Staying on this topic, Sara, do you think that if there was a tax revolt, it would force a kind of real reform? Would the collapse of the fiscus force the government to change? And would it change the battle of ideas? If, say, the government fell because of the sort of collapse of the fiscus, would a new government be forced to adopt more free market policies?
That probably unlikely. The best we could hope for is, if a tax boycott were to be successful, is that the government would sooner rather than later be replaced. I don't know if it would adopt the right policies, because while you and I and most decent ordinary people want to see an improvement in the lives of South Africans, I genuinely believe that the ANC's function is simply to keep the ANC in existence. And those are two very, very different things. So I'm not sure it would work, although I do like the idea, because it's one hell of a message. But to organize a tax boycott, legal or illegal, I just don't see how you do it.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, one of the things you need to think about that, unfortunately, the people who call for a tax boycott often don't, is how most taxes are paid. Most income tax and corporate tax is not paid on like a you earn your money first and then you voluntarily go hand it over to SARS later system. So to have a really effective tax revolt, you'd have to have big corporates come along to the party that would be very easily identified, and you'd have to have big banks. You'd have to have the major employers kind of allowed. Otherwise, it's basically just going to be freelancers. And big business in South Africa has been the most eager to bend the knee to Emperor Frog Boiler. And so happy Women's Day. I I think it's impractical at that level, is that it's a mechanism in order to trigger, you need big corporates to come to the party first. And I think they'll be the last to come to the party. I think a much more viable thing is, peaceful protest, organized lobbying. I think we're going to have to win the battle of ideas in a lot of other ways before that becomes remotely viable.
Well said. Now we're going to move on to our next topic for today, and our last one briefly, which is a part of the world that's not really talked about that much. And that is, of course, what has been described as Europe's last dictatorship, or one of the most authoritarian countries in Europe, which is, of course, the nation of Belarus. Belarus is borders Russia and Poland and Lithuania, and it became independent when the Soviet Union collapsed. Its leader, Lukashenko, has been in power since 1994. And there was an election, I believe, yesterday in Belarus, which, like most previous elections under Lukashenko, was widely thought to be fraudulent and to have a lot of cheating going on. The opposition candidate, whose name I am going to struggle to pronounce here, Tikhanovskaya. Yeah, there we go. Thank you, Gabriel. has said that she actually has won the vote, despite the official results showing her only getting 9.9% of the vote and Lukashenko getting 80% of the vote. However, independent, or rather not independent, but opposition polling booth volunteers who have looked at the individual results of each station claim that the opposition actually won something like 60% of the vote rather than the 80%. Lukashenko is an interesting character because he has tried to both get closer to Russia and Putin, but at the same time, keep Belarus independent, so has emphasized Belarusian culture as a distinct thing from Russia. He's referred to the opposition as sheep controlled from abroad, and referred to his presidential opponent as, quote, a poor little girl manipulated by foreign puppet masters. Lukashenko is under a lot of pressure in Belarus from his handling of various issues, particularly COVID, which he said could be cured with a sauna and vodka. Gabriel, are we going to see a fall of Lukashenko's regime? There's been major riots now, or at least protests across Belarus over the past couple of days in response to this election.
Yeah, it's that seems unlikely to me. I kind of want to dwell on the vodka sauna combination to beat COVID, because I've got to say, it sounds tempting. And if he could convince, of course, Zanat Lamini Zuma that vodka actually cures COVID, then maybe that'd be progress in terms of lifting the alcohol ban, whether or not it's true. No, but in terms of Belarusians' internal politics, the major problem when you have a dictatorship like that, or long-term autocrat like that, is that is you get the incumbency replacement dilemma, where everything becomes so centered around one particular leader, the balance of forces turns so much on his hand that one worries, I think, even if one is highly critical, that a replacement would result in even greater devastation. And this is a very typical worry across Russia and a lot of Slavic countries' history for a very long time. That's why the common phrase is Russians love a Tsar. Even if the Tsar is no good, at least it's stable. and revolution can often be truly lethally disruptive. So I don't think that they'll want to push so hard or that they'll be able to push so hard as to topple him. In the meanwhile, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, she speaks well. Her politics seem relatively sound. But it's hard to verify the claims that the vote was as rigged as she claims it has been. It does seem extreme, not impossible, but it's the kind of thing where one hopes that genuinely independent auditors will be able to come forward and give us some clarity on that. I think one thing just to understand about Belarus is that, you know, to many Russians, it's basically just a fabulous dairy sitting on their border. It's famous for having the best milk products, the best cheese, the best yogurts, and not a lot of industry besides that, and being a very pretty sort of gardeny place to go and visit. So I don't know that there's a real threat of Russia usurping autonomy or sovereignty at this point. But I do think that all of those countries sort of in between the EU and Russia, their politics are to a large extent defined by whether one's vision for the country is to drift further west or to drift further east. And of course, that's the source of the of Lyuchenko's grievance against Tikhanovskaya, to say, you know, she seems more friendly to the EU project than to Putin's Orthodox Christian Slav centric way of seeing things.
Can I surmise that it's for a man who's been in power for 26 odd years, the chances in an area that is in a part of the world that's been used to autocratic rule for an enormously long period of time, the chances are that change would only happen when he dies. And that change depends on succession and the extent to which you have a very conservative old guard versus the more enlightened new guard, et cetera, et cetera. I think the biggest problem for Belarus, I mean, there's some strong sort of historical issues, but I think the biggest problem for Belarus is it's in that part of the world where, you know, you can be a little autocratic for a long time and no one really pays a lot of attention. It's just not going to get the sort of breast beating, has this been rigged or not rigged, response from the West. It's almost like in a sort of bubble. And having been part of the Soviet Union, I think that's enabled his 26 year reign. But in that respect, he certainly has an ally in Putin as far as longevity goes. And I think you're looking at the same elements of manliness, shall I put it that way?
Yeah, no, exactly. And I mean, you know, it's for a very clear neighborly comparison, Ukraine has had a war in the Donbass ongoingly since about 6 years ago. And it's like no one cares anymore, right? Because it's just in that part of the world, it's in that sort of don't care bubble, where it's not clear how much a victor can really gain, how many resources there are. There's not much in the way of capital and industry. It's not clear geopolitically how much of a difference makes to anyone excepting the Russians and EU sort of military adventurists who want to stretch their borders further east. The Russians want to stretch their borders further west, basically to get more distance between Berlin and Moscow, as if this is 1930. The geopolitical forces that create the tension also create a kind of don't care attitude that I think one only really sees in the same way in Syria, in parts of the Middle East that have just been so messed up for so long that it's hard to see a light at the end of the tunnel. And so people kind of switch off when they hear it. But it is interesting about the election, and I'll certainly be watching it. In terms of rigged elections, I just want to add, I know someone in Russia who just participated in their constitutional referendum election who won 3,000 rubles just for participating in the election. So So that's not rigging exactly, but I thought if the ANC finds out you can bribe people to come to the elections by having a lottery where every thousandth person wins like a free bottle of whiskey, we might see our voter turnout go up again, which I think would be really good for the country, actually.
Well, we'll have to see. Let's not get too excited about these innovations. We will have to see. Of course, the opposition leader of Belarus has now fled to Lithuania for her own safety, which suggests that the government is able to regain control.